Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Gotta get your brain right if you're trying to make $1 million. If you ain't gonna do it for yourself, then do it for your mama. Only stay surrounded by them people if you know they solid. Elevate your hustle up today to double up your profit. Trying to learn some game, Xavier gonna talk about it. No, Deanna, speak that shit that everybody vouching. Ain't no more excuses valid. Get up off the couch and get up in your bag. To your bank account, need an accountant.
Yo, 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 welcome back to the greatest show on earth, the Millionaire Mindsets Podcast. I am your gracious host, Xavier Miller. And before we start this episode, I would like to advise all the watchers and the viewers to please like, subscribe, hit that 5-star rate and review. We're trying to run those numbers up, getting ready for 2024. So if y'all could do all those things, we would greatly appreciate it. And getting right into the show, y'all know I don't like to waste no time. I like to get straight to it. I got a super, super dope guest, and I don't say that lightly. When we've been talking about bringing her on the show for, it's been a minute now, so to finally have her in the studio to get it done, I'm extremely excited. She's an SEC attorney. She's an Olympian. Just a dope person that's doing amazing, amazing things. Like I said, warm welcome for LaVon Idolette. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
I'm glad I said that right. So welcome to the show. I'm super glad to have you here.
I'm super glad to be here, although Dallas is much colder than my expectations. I can't
lie. it'd be up and down like that, man. It was kind of like 70 last week, and then the past couple of days, I don't know what happened. It just dropped. It's a messed up thing. So let's get right into it. So for the people, this may be their first time seeing you, hearing you. They might have been stuck under a rock, not paying attention to what's going on in the world. Give some brief background on yourself. Let the listeners know who you are.
Yeah. So I'm LaVon Idolette. I was an Olympic athlete. I did track and field. I went to the 2012 Olympics, ran 100-meter hurdles. At the same time, I was in law school, so I now do securities law. And I run a consortium of companies that help you be a wealth keeper and accelerator. So what that means is I help you put together the foundations of things, such as trusts and holding companies, but also create wealth acceleration tools like funds, syndications, and the things that allow you to raise capital and be an abundant giver. So set up those foundations because you need all of those things to preserve and grow your wealth.
Mm. Let's take it back for a second. So how did you even start to get into all of that? Because that's crazy to get into.
So the true story is that, like, my dad thinks he's the brain and that I'm Pinky. So
Pinky and the brain.
I was growing up, my father's a developer, and he would say, like, go get this license, go do this. I think you should study this. I think you should go and do these things from high school. And that's how I got involved, starting with real estate and that sort of thing very young. And then after I finished law school, I met a mentor that told me, like, I like what you're doing with real estate, but I think you could do it at a higher level. Took me to a conference. And that conference, the lady told me that everything I was doing was cute, which is like $1 to $5 million deals, and that she would give me money if I did something over $80 million. And I said,
she would give you money if you did something over $80 million.
So I said, first of all, I was too calm. So obviously I'm missing something. And it made me dive very deep in learning what securities were, how to raise capital, and how the top families in the world were protecting and growing their wealth.
So let's get right into it. What you saying that, because these are things I've always been interested in. So how do the top families grow and maintain their wealth? Because a lot of families, they say the statistics say, like, most wealthy families lose their wealth in 1 to 2 generations. Mm-hmm. So the ones that's able to keep it, how are they doing it?
Yeah, so a good amount of it is they're protecting the wealth from future bad decisions. So that's putting things in trust and having trustees that know what's going on and allowing only distributions of the what the money is making versus like letting the balance decline. That's number one. Number two is they are co-investing with each other, participating in each other's deals so that they can make above market returns and just grow at a steady pace. So while, you know, the general public is putting their money in CDs, which is making 3%, high yield savings account making 4%, you have people who are doing deals that's making 16 to 25% annualized and is compounding over time. So their $1 million turns into $10 million while the average person's $1 million turns into $1,060,000 because it's been in the bank account for 10 years.
That's so interesting. I met this guy from, he was like a descendant of the people that created Quaker Oats.
Okay.
And there's like a $1 billion family or whatever. And he was telling me, I want to ask you, like, is this really a comment? He was telling me that, like, in his family, you can't touch the money. It's like certain milestones or like ages. And it's not like young ages, like 50 years old and stuff. I'm like, what the hell? 50 years old to touch the money? Is that like a common thing that like wealthy families do?
Yes, because think about the type of decisions you make at 21, at 30 with money. So they're giving you enough time to mature your desires before allowing you to like take big chunks. And that's not to say that like most people's trusts are giving them a reasonable amount of money to live on, which like reasonable depends on your lifestyle. But the bigger part of that is just giving them time to mature and never decline in the balance. So the principle of the balance is never going to go down. They're only giving you what the money is making.
Because just for the audience and everybody that's listening, how do trusts protect families and individuals and break down the difference between a trust and a will? Because I feel like a lot of people use those two things interchangeably.
Yes. Okay, so a will is a document that tells a court what to do when someone dies. And the court gets to interpret which will should be effective and all that. Because a lot of people create a will, forget about it, make another one, and it'll be a bunch of different documents. And so you'll have a lot of people arguing in court, and then the court system gets to decide. So I tell most people, if you have anything worth arguing over, you definitely want to have it in trust. And so when you have a trust, an irrevocable trust owns the assets. You no longer own the assets. They're not inside of your estate. And the reason why people do that, especially with significant wealth, is they're trying to avoid like wealth tax, which is what has to be paid when you die for your descendants to get the money. So there is a maximum amount that you can do in your lifetime as a gift to others. And that number right now is $13,800,000.
You can get that to somebody tax-free.
Yes. Above that, they'll be paying a death tax. And so imagine you thinking you're getting some great amount of money, and when you when it's first, you have to argue with people in court, probably for a year or so, if you have a will. Then the money's going to be taxed, and it creates a burden for your family. So when you have things in trust, it's literally a document that governs how your money will be invested and distributed to your heirs or your beneficiaries. And so those beneficiaries it can say whatever it wants per se, because it's more or less a contract and we're free to contract however we want in America, but it has provisions like the trustee has discretion to give you a distribution. Why is that important? So like, let's say your kid gets married and is going through a divorce, and in that divorce, they get lifetime alimony, not lifetime, that's too long. So let's say they get like alimony of some sort for 5 years. If you have a discretional trust provision, your trustee will know to not make a distribution in those years, because the money that can be given away has to be in your possession for the person. So now there's nothing to give. So The premise of that, though, is you're protecting your wealth from it going out to future ex-wives and all that kind of stuff.
That's important.
It's super important because you never know what kind of eventualities can happen. So a lot of people talk about the Kennedys and the Rockefellers and all that, but like most of their wealth was protected because you can get into a car accident and the judgment doesn't affect that family's wealth at all because it's on that person. If we don't make a distribution, there's no money to take.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yes. Is trust only for wealthy people?
No. So trusts are more expensive than wills are,
right.
But if you have anything worth arguing over, it's a good enough cause to have a trust that even if it just has paid on death benefits, so like insurance policies that are paid to the trust so that it's an easy transfer and it gives you a little bit more control, especially if you like, let's say you die and you have younger kids.
Right.
You will have the control to say, I want to make sure that my kids are doing something productive with their lives. And I don't want them to get $10 million at one time or $1 million at one time because they'll self-destruct.
No question.
Allowing them to get a reasonable amount of money and be sort of living in a way that you think is positive based on your ideas then. So it could be like, as long as they don't do drugs, as long as they go to college, as long as they are being a good citizen of the world, you know. So most people call that ruling from the grave, but a good piece of that is more or less just making sure that you're passing on the right ideas and transfer of knowledge to your kids as well as the money.
Because I say that all the time, is generational wealth is definitely education too, because you could give somebody the money, and that money could be gone within a general, where I'm from, man, people blow so money. They blow money so quick, it'd be gone in a summer.
Yes.
You have a good enough summer, all the money will be gone, for real.
But that's why I tell people all the time, like, they try to denigrate when people get money and like, oh, you know, you had it easy because somebody gave you money. I'm like, do you know how many people get money and blow it?
Like, literally, like, I don't know the statistics on this, but it seems like most people blow it.
Yes. It's definitely a much higher percentage of those that turn it into more money or like some great enterprise.
That's crazy because I feel like in our, especially in the black community, we have this thing like still to this day where we kind of like shit on people that come from money. It's like it's more honorable if you got it out the mud.
Yeah.
That's how we see it in a lot of times.
And I question that every single time because if you tell me that you want to be the generational curse breaker, blah, 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 but you talk trash about the person who grew up with money, you're basically talking trash about your future generations.
Exactly.
And so do you want them to have it or not?
Exactly. When you put it like that, it don't make sense that people, when people do have those conversations and say stuff like that.
Exactly. And I think that most of it is just people believe that they want to have like a trauma off or a struggle Olympics to say like, I got it a harder way than you. But like, is that admirable, or should you just be happy that you survived and you made it? And like, yeah, there are easier ways.
Yeah, but, you know, that's real. And I know, like, family wealth, and that's extremely important to you. How do you think that is a undervalued topic within our community?
I think that managing, maintaining, and passing on knowledge and money is a super under-talked about topic in our community. But it also comes from the fact that, like, our community has sort of identified with being the impoverished.
Damn.
And so, like, if you are only seeing yourself as the people who live paycheck to paycheck or the people who are in a struggle class, then you can't ever have conversations around, like, what does it look like to make sure that everybody in my family has insurance on them? What does it look like to give the knowledge that you have? And whatever that may be, it still has value, even if you don't have the money per se. Because I know a lot of people who have a lot of skill. Sometimes they're just not good business people. So then, like, they have messed the money up in some way.
Yep.
So now they think, like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. But that level of knowledge can help the next person take that knowledge and apply some better business tactics to it and, like, turn it into something good.
Why do you think I'm generalizing, of course, when I say we. But why do you think we identify with that? You say because we identify with, like, the impoverished mentality.
So that's media-driven.
You think so?
Yeah. So, like, the media very much makes poverty a blackface, which is very weird to me, considering that we have less people in this country than there are impoverished others.
Exactly.
But, you know, if you have to create a face, it is easier to make it the other than the majority.
You think that's intentional?
Yes.
I like the straightforward answers. I like it. I got my own opinions and I believe so too, but I love to hear other people's thoughts and opinions on it.
Yeah, I love to have conversations with young people and tell them to stop identifying with struggles. Like, you are not those things. And it's just like when I went to law school, people would always say, like, oh, the bar passage rate is this at that school, you shouldn't go there. And I say, well, to be honest, everything is 100% or zero. So I'm either going to pass or fail. I don't really care what anybody else does. So you are either going to pass, that's 100%, or you're going to fail, that's 0%. What the other people do has absolutely nothing to do with you. So you have to focus on microeconomics to get macro change. So if I focus on myself, making my family better, and then helping others along the way, one by one, you then have a macro effect. But if you're like, oh, look at us, it's like 100 million of you and you, nothing's going to happen. Yeah, that's like an impossible task versus just being like, my father used to always say to me, am I my brother's keeper? Of course I am. But my job to my brother is to make sure I take care of myself so he doesn't have to take care of me. And that's a bar. The type of thinking that I try to push on kids, like, just take care of yourself. You be accountable to you, and then you own that. And that energy passes on to others, and others will continue to do that as well.
No, that was a bar. And I got some more I want to ask you, because I know you work with and been around a lot of, like, wealthy people and stuff like that. What, like, I'm trying to think of the way to ask this. What age typically are the people that you're working with that's been around that are wealthy, what age are they typically, like the age range? And it's the reason I'm asking this.
Okay, so I work with both ends of the spectrum. So athletes, entertainers, people who have sold companies, especially now because we're in the age of information. So we have way more people who are making money and they're like 19, 20 years old. So that's one extreme. And the other extreme is like people who have just like done something over time and it just like compounds and then they're like in their 60s.
Right.
And so we were actually joking about this morning because I was at a conference last week and the main sponsor was a crypto coin. And in these spaces, if the average age of a wealthy person in this space is 65, they think crypto is BS. So for you to spend your money as a sponsor there, they're very much like, who they thought was spending by that?
Facts. That's facts. No, that's facts. And I asked that because I think I talk to a lot of people all the time, younger people, and it's like we have this idea that like we should have it by like 35. Some people, I talk to, so you won't believe the messages I get from people that's under 28. Yeah. They're like, man, my life is shit. I'm a failure because I don't got this amount of money. And I'm like, yo, where do y'all get this idea that you're supposed to be wealthy by 30 from?
Yeah. I think that everything is media driven for the most part, especially like the pressure that young people put on themselves to have certain things by a certain time. And I think it's super negative, mainly because like in real life, things take time to cultivate, especially skill. Facts. So like if you just spend time cultivating your skill, maybe it takes you a little bit longer, but it's fine. But at the end of the day, most of the people who you think got what they got don't. So there's that.
Say that. Real talk. Let me ask you this. We talk about being an SEC lawyer for the watchers and viewers. What is an SEC lawyer?
Yeah, so securities is when there's a common enterprise, which means one company, and you are allowing others to participate in the profits without participating. Which means that, like, you have a passive investor. Mm-hmm. And the passive investor expects to get a profit without doing anything. That's selling securities. A lot of people think that they can have silent investors and all that, and they're just like, yeah, it's great. I'm like, yeah, you probably are illegally selling securities. Whether it's debt or equity, they control both sides of the coin. And so I see a lot of shenanigans on the internet. And
no. Facts.
But most people haven't seen the extreme other side of what it looks like to get in trouble with the SEC.
What you mean by that?
So you've illegally sold securities to somebody. They think they're your passive investor, whatever the case may be, friend, family. Friends and family complain faster than everybody else, by the way. So, you know, you took their money, no paperwork, no SEC filing, no nothing. And let's say you messed the money up. That happens all the time. There's actually nothing illegal about losing money. It's illegal to take people's money without giving disclosures on the risk. And that's all they are controlling. So we create the paperwork and do the filings with the SEC and FINRA to make sure that you are compliantly raising capital. And we only do exempt offerings. So exempt offerings is, so a non-exempt offering would be like an IPO.
Okay.
Where you have to submit all this documentation, and it costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of time. An exempt offering, you have some disclosures, which is known as like a private placement memorandum and a subscription agreement, anti-money laundering, because we can't take no funny money.
Facts.
And a suitability questionnaire, because you shouldn't take people's money if you don't know their financial situation.
Mm.
And then you file a form depending on what type of exemption you want to use, and that's it. That's all you have to do, and you can go out and raise money. If you don't have those things in place, you will void your exemption from having to file all the paperwork, and then they will pursue you, lock up your bank accounts, all kinds of things. They have real wide discretion as it pertains to protecting the public from people taking their money under false pretenses. So, yeah, you need paperwork. Everything in writing is true. Yeah. Everything else is your word against theirs. And if you are supposed to be the sophisticated person, they're going to use your words against you.
Mm, that's true. That's definitely true. How important, let me ask you this, because there's a lot of people online these days that's raising money. Then you got people online that see somebody that's raising money. They're like, oh, they could flip my money. I'm going to send them $50,000. I'm going to send them $100,000. How important is it for these individuals to have an advisor, a lawyer, before they do any deals with somebody they see online?
So number one, if you are not a paperwork reader, you should definitely have an attorney. And I think you should have an attorney either way, just because the wording is built so that you may or may not understand all of the terms. But giving people money without doing due diligence is like running rampant in the world. And due diligence meaning just like you know who they are, what they're doing, what they intend to do with the money, what they do with their normal money, where they be hanging at, where they live. Like, y'all don't know anything about these people and you just wire money. What? And then be like, they stole my money. They scammed me. You scammed yourself.
Damn.
Because at the end of the day, we all have to be accountable to ourselves. And when you decide it, and I get it that like a lot of people are looking for the thing that is the hope that gets them to the next level.
Yep.
But at the same time, most things that sound too good to be true with people who don't have a track record in the thing are definitely overly ambitious and not based on reality, because everything sounds good on paper. And this is what I tell people who are like academic people swear they the goats because they have an MBA, they have a finance degree. And I'm like, yeah, everything works on paper. Have you ever been in a business? How many of those clients that you had last year did you retain next year? And if you retain them, what did you have to do to retain them? How much did it cost? And all those sorts of things. But in an MBA project, it just goes like this, no matter what. Because, I mean, there's no checks and balances to, like, real-world scenarios.
So, for people that's watching, right? So say they got somebody proposing them some business opportunities and like, oh, I could flip your money and get you 25% in whatever time frame. What are some key indicators people should be looking for before they give anybody anything? Like, what should be like the checklist to say this, check?
So number one, who is the person? Because great ideas don't matter. It's great execution. So if you want to know what have they done in the past, who's on the team, who is facilitating, who's working there day to day to make sure it happens. Also, how much money are they raising? Is that enough money to actually do the thing? Because what I see the most in business is people are not raising enough money to actually do the thing. So they'll say like, this is how much money I need. And I'm like, yeah, well, did you think about closing costs and contingency fees and what if about run over? And like, running out of money is a death sentence in most.
Facts. That's how most businesses.
Exactly. And so that's step one, the people. You want to know about the people. Before you even look at the deal, you need to look at the people. And once you say, okay, I trust the people a little bit, then you look at the deal. And then you want to make sure that the math is mathing. Most people's math ain't mathing. So that is a clear, like, if you can't, in hypothetical world, which is just like your pro forma, make the numbers add up, is no way in real life it's going to happen. So that's red flag number two. Red flag number three is, well, then you go down to like feasibility in terms of like what's going on in the world. Is this the right vehicle to be in? Like a person could be like, I got the best idea and I think we should go out and like build new newspapers. And you're like, who reads newspapers?
It's 2023. Who's doing
it? right. But so you need to kind of have a little bit of foresight in where the world is going and stuff like that, and whether that opportunity is a growing opportunity or it's just something that like. The worst part about the age of information is I swear that people refuse to Google in advance. So, like, I get pitched things all the time, and I'm like, but that already exists.
Right.
That already exists. Like, I'm going to put together a thing, and the people going to be able to pick you up in front of your house. That app exists already.
Oh, we've been here for a minute.
Right. But it literally be that level of, like, so you didn't do any research. It's just like when a person tells you they have no competition. Maybe not directly, but there is no way that you are, maybe you shouldn't feel yourself this much to believe that you are so smart that nobody else has thought about a single thing that's in this realm.
Mm. And I want to talk about raising capital for a second, because like okay. You just mentioned, most businesses fail at the end of the day because they don't have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that you've been doing, you do on a high level. So how can these businesses, whether they're small businesses, decent-sized business, get out here and raise more money?
Yeah, so I am sort of, I'm not going to say I'm anti-raising money for a business, it's just harder. My general suggestion to most people is that you need to be raising money as a co-investment to a business, like an asset. So what that means is like you can allow somebody to participate in your intellectual property of some sort. So like let's say you own a patent and you're going to license it out. You would have an entity that owns that patent and they can participate in that. And your company owns some and their company owns some and you divvy it out. It's much easier for you to raise capital on a specific thing than it is like your business growth for the future. At least from my standpoint, because venture is much harder to raise for than private equity or private debt, just because there is a specific thing that you're asking for money for. So like this building exists, mm-hmm. and you can say, all right, I already own a business. And me and my business is going to be a partner in purchasing this building. You can get investors to line up to give you money for that because the building is a thing that exists already and it has the ability to have numbers that make sense, not in like future conception. And so it's easy to raise money for that versus like I have an idea of a business that will exist in the future. Like people have to bet on you too much for that.
That's some heavy game because that's something that people always want to know, especially today. Like I could get out here and raise some money for this idea or business I got. So that's definitely some good information for people to take. I want to ask you what would you say? Like you've been done some great things on a high level, but I want to ask you what's been your biggest regrets?
Ooh, okay. So I'd say my biggest regret was. When the downturn happened
in the housing market
in 2008, I was flipping houses before that. I had a mortgage license and I was running track and I was in school. So I was like, okay, this is my like little time to do nothing, more or less. I think that was a mistake because the opportunities to buy in South Florida were so great. Like you couldn't give the properties away, like $10,000 houses in Opa-locka that are worth $600,000 now, like that level from 2009 to 2014, there was just not a lot of activity. And I worked in the bankruptcy court from 2011 to 2014. So I saw the amount of people just like, they got to get out of there. Like, because the worst thing that can happen, and most people don't think about it in this way, because if somebody's willing to give you the money, most people just take the money, right? So you buy these houses, lots and lots and lots and lots of houses, because you can get access to the capital. But if they don't have a cash flowing machine someplace else, like a job or a business that creates money, you end up living on the rents. Well, what happens when the rents don't come in and you owe a mortgage? Your house of cards starts tumbling really fast.
Quick.
And so, or you'll have like, oh, you own a house in Chicago, they got leaks and frozen pipes and all that kind of stuff. Your tenants do not care about your cash flow. You got to fix those pipes today.
Yep.
And so all of that was creating these like snowballs, because people were getting approved to own lots of things without having like that financial background on the other side. And so I was watching people's entire portfolios go into bankruptcy, and it was such a big opportunity there that I just like watched as opposed to like participating.
But that's crazy. You said an open locker, they had $10,000 homes.
Listen. In 2012. Like, it was literally, and then, you know, they opened an Amazon over there. So that always bolsters an area. But
that's like unbelievable for real.
Yeah.
$10,000 homes in South Florida.
Man, South Florida was so cheap when I moved there. Like, it was literally what people think Texas is now. Like, South Florida, when I moved there in 2007, it was a cheap place to live and it was beautiful. And now it's the most expensive place
everybody
in the
country.
Everybody
wanna go there.
It's ridiculous.
What's the pros and cons of living in South Florida? And I'm asking this because I was thinking about moving there before I moved to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, man, it's so lit out there. I won't be able to stay focused.
Yeah. So pros and cons. Pros, you can fly anywhere in the world direct from 3 airports. So you got a lot of options. And for the low, for real. Like, the Caribbean, $120, you can get in.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Facts.
So that's a positive. Second positive is, if you are a marginally good business person, you'll do great. Because everybody's terrible. They don't call you back. They don't show up. Everybody has an excuse. But that's going to fall into my con side, because birds of a feather flock together. Which means when you're in New York, you behave like a New Yorker. You show up on time. You're always urgent about getting business done. South Florida is filled with people who are doing a little bit of funny things, a little bit of fugazi things, and they're all like, oh, so you ain't going to brunch? You're not going to sit on the beach? And that becomes the attitude of everybody. So they're figuring out how to finesse versus like showing up and being good business people. So if you're just a regular good business person, you're like crush.
That's crazy. But that makes so much sense, because it shows you how like the environment in any situation can influence not only you, but the whole, everybody there.
There's an exodus to South Florida. Lots of businesses moved there. Like from
leaving?
New York, California, all that.
Right.
And everybody's like, it's going to be great. It's going to be a great Texan. And I'm like, it's going to be terrible. You guys have no idea what it's like to be a person who expects a lot, because you were in New York, you were in Silicon Valley, things happen, people move fast, and then like everybody shows up late to your meetings, or they don't show up, no call, no show. And you'll have your top talent now turn into those people because they're in the elevator in their buildings, and the person, like, they're dressed up and everybody else has on night clothes and they walking their dog at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
They're like, and now you're like, what am I doing? I'm living life wrong. Just like you said, the young people say, I'm not doing this right. Why I don't got a Bugatti?
No. South Florida will make you, it makes you feel like you're retired. That's why I tell people when I go, I'm like, I can't stay here for too long, because I feel like I'm retired already. I'm kicking it. That's just the vibe of the whole like area. It just feels so relaxed and chill.
And that's why I create so many scammers, because people want to figure out how to be rich without
get more
being
for less.
Rich. Yeah.
That's that makes so much sense. I never put it into that perspective before. I want to go back to trust for a second. So break down like the different kind of trust, because I know people usually when they mention trust, they hear irrevocable trust. I know a lot of people are aware of that.
Yeah.
What are other kinds of trust that people can get?
Yeah, so there are only two types of trust from that regard, revocable and irrevocable. And so there are lots of revocable types, but revocable just means that it can be changed at any time. Irrevocable, once it's created,
you can't change it.
the beneficiaries could go through a process of getting some of the provisions changed if they all agree. And it stays within the spirit of what the grantor, which is the person who created the trust, has. But generally, once it's set up and that's it. And the trustee's whole job is to make sure that everything in those wishes are carried out, that the investments are done a certain way, that the distributions are done a certain way. And but with revocable, the thing that makes me angry is because they talk about trust like it's like this or that, but it's really a contract. So you have a lot of flexibility inside of it. But the one thing about revocable trust is it's not an asset protection tool. It's a privacy tool. So if you have things in a revocable trust, not only do you still pay taxes on it because it's still in your estate, but you also still are liable for the things that happen with that property personally because it's still yours.
It's still yours. Is that what it's saying? Own nothing, control everything comes from?
That is what an irrevocable trust does. So a revocable trust, you still own it and you control it. Irrevocable trust is when you control it, but you don't own it.
So who owns it?
The trust.
The trust owns. So the trust owns the trust.
Own assets. So a trust is just like any other business entity. So when you have something that's inside of an LLC or a corporation, that corporation owns those assets. So a trust is just an entity type.
Okay. That makes, because I feel like a lot of people hear the conversation. Because when I first learned about trust, I was confused as shit. I'm not going to lie. I'm like, yo, this is hella damn confusing to me. Because it's a lot, but it's definitely necessary.
Yes.
Because I've been seeing people end up, like, even, for example, my grandfather, when he passed away, he had money, but he didn't. That older generation, they don't really think about trust and wills. He ain't have neither.
Yeah.
So when he passed away, all his stuff went up to probate.
Yeah. And y'all fought for how long in court to get
the... And never got nothing. Because my mom wasn't his biological daughter. So nothing.
So intestate, which means dying without a will, there's just like state level rules. It goes to your wife first, then your kids, then your this and that. So if the person is a non-blood relative, there's nothing to protect them at all.
Yeah.
And that's super tragic because you know that the person would have wanted to take care of, you know.
You know it. And mm-hmm. these conversations, I feel like we don't have these conversations too much in our community, for real.
For sure not. And the reason is because people believe that having conversations about death is like dying, which is like a very strange...
I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Because
I'm like, it's sort of like the same conversation as like, if you get a prenuptial agreement, that means you're planning for divorce. And I'm like, no. Literally, you create all contracts when you are in the best mindset possible. So that... Because once you angry... Everything is petty.
No, that's a fact. That's a fact. Is you trying to get over on them? Somebody trying to get over on you?
So I think that it's super important to not only have conversations about death, succession planning, and all of that, especially for business people, because most people are not financeable because they don't have a succession plan.
Let me ask you this, because you brought up prenups. So I got to ask this. What do you feel about prenups? Does everybody have one?
So... I create trust so that people don't need prenups, but you can get prenups. I think that like the conversation should be had, period.
Why?
Because most people's relationships break down due to uncommunicated expectations. So if you're not communicating what you expect inside of this marriage, or if something is to break down or you decide to break up, like you have kids and all kinds of stuff, you want to know what's going to happen. Like, do you intend to like not care about us when you upset? Like, we need to know this in advance. So I think the conversation should be had, but the trust setup allows you to not need a prenup.
Really?
Yeah. Cause you don't own anything.
Cause you own it.
Yeah. So now whatever we get together is what we get together.
But even still, there's still a lot of people that's kind of like, turned off by their conversations. Like, I know people, I've heard plenty of people that when they even bring up the thought of prenuptial anything or having a conversation where it's contractual, if this happened, they're like, why are we doing that? You think it's going to end badly? You know, a lot of people, it seemed like it's more women based than anything. It seemed like dudes generally like, let's do this. Let's sort this out just in case. Women, it seems like, be like, no, that's kind of bad. Look, that's bad, like, juju on a relationship.
Yeah, I think that that's like grandparent talk in their ear and their belief system. But, like, a good amount of, I usually laugh at it because most of the guys who I know who are, like, super, I ain't even talking to a girl if we ain't getting a prenup. Like, they be so worried about gold diggers while not having enough gold to care. So, like, come on.
Sheesh.
You guys are worried about the wrong thing. But at the same time, I think that it's super important to know, like, if you are already doing really well, you need to know where people stand in your life. Because some people know how to be purposefully good to you
while things are good.
While things are good. And knowing that, like, so if a person knows that you were underhugged growing up, then they're going to hug you really a lot, right? Until they get, oh, we married now, baby, ain't no hugs for you.
Damn, that's so do you think, like, so let's say some people that come in on the same level financially, right? Because mm-hmm. this is also a lot of common thing with people. They're like, we on the same level. We've got the same amount of money. Mm-hmm. We don't need a prenup. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's a true statement?
I think that same level of money is relative because not everybody's on the same trajectory. So to say, like, all right, let's keep all of our things together could be positive or negative. I think most things are situational, but you should still probably have a, like, let's build a life together. We're going to have a common set of money that we're going to do things with, and then we'll have separate money. And does that need to be in a contract? Maybe or maybe not. I think it's personal.
What's the craziest thing you personally seen from somebody not having a trust or a prenup, any of that?
So the no prenup, this happens like at least once a week. A new person I meet, and it's mostly men saying how they're having to rebuild their life because they had to give so much in this, like, divorce that they didn't see coming.
Yep.
For one reason or another. Now, the not seeing the divorce coming part, I'm sort of like,
yeah.
So you just wasn't paying attention.
That's what that means.
Because there's no way. Like, there are usually signs. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that happens so often that it, like, has created the, like, turn off of people wanting to be married. Because they're like, if I'm going to be risk, like, this level of risk is too much for me.
It's hard.
And so I literally watch that happen all the time where they're just like, okay, I'm starting from nothing. Like, I have a client and he now just started a new hedge fund. But when he got divorced, he gave his wife all the money and the house and he slept in his car for 6 months.
I know.
So, and he's just like, the reason was because I don't want my kid to suffer ever.
Right.
Ever. I don't want her to see me argue. And I saw the direction it was going with the wife's attorney and all that. And, like, I was just like, you got it, bro, and left.
That's so crazy. That made me just think of something, because I know somebody too that they was married for a decade. And when they got divorced because he found out she was cheating on him. So she wanted a divorce to get with a new guy.
Uh-huh.
And then so he lost the house. She got full custody of the kids. And he had to pay child support.
Yeah.
And he told me he had the savings, and his savings got completely wiped out for lawyer fees, yep. then giving her money. So he's like, I'm left assed out with nothing. He said, I don't even got no furniture, like, yep. nothing. So I'm like, that's a reason, kind of what you just brought up, where a lot of men these days, they kind of like, the risk of marriage is just too high. Because if she gets her emotions, or if I don't want to be with her no more, I'm going to lose everything I got.
Yeah.
She's going to take everything, and I'm going to be left out with nothing, and I'm going to have to pay. Like, I understand why a lot of dudes think that way.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I literally listen to both sides of the story, where I watch people stay in relationships they don't want to be in because they don't have a financial backup plan, or they, like the lifestyle more than they like the person.
Right. right.
But then on the other side of that, just being like, it's cheaper to keep her. Is a very normal conversation I hear of business people all the time who are just like, well, yeah, you know, I go sleep with prostitutes because that's a whole nother conversation.
Right.
But the whole thing being, I'm afraid to make a move towards my happiness because of all of these other ramifications. Right.
This is my final thing regarding prenups. I've also heard that prenups can get, like, practically, like, thrown out of court. Is that true?
Yeah. So a lot of people's prenup get thrown out in court because you either had them sign it under duress, which happens the most.
What does that mean, though?
Under duress means under pressure. So, like, the wedding's today. Here's the paper or we ain't getting married. That's duress. Like, you can't do it.
But how do they prove that in court if they got married, like, 5, 8, 10, 20 years before that?
Because you signed the date on it. And you know what the date of the marriage is.
Okay.
And so those sorts of things get you thrown out. But the biggest reason that that prenups get thrown out is because you didn't disclose all your assets.
Really?
Yeah.
So I didn't know that.
It's so easy to, like, especially if you're trying to move assets into other entities and that sort of thing. So, like, yeah. So that's why I tell people, get your affairs in order before you get engaged. Because if you do that, you don't have to disclose. It's just no longer on the table. But, like, if you have assets in your name, you get engaged and you're in contemplation of marriage, you now have to disclose what you have before you can move it into a trust. Or it would be like you're hiding the assets.
Really? See, yeah. I didn't know that. I've always wondered, why do they just get...
But, like, some states have a very clear line of, like, Florida, we got some good laws. But one of those laws is everything you had before the marriage is yours exclusively. And then whatever you have moving forward is y'all's together. But if you, like, let's say you had a house before and y'all live in the house as a family house, it becomes marital property. But that's an overtime thing. But all that other stuff, like if you made millions of dollars before that, it's not considered marital property. But Florida got good laws. Not everybody got good laws now.
That's wild, yo. See, I've heard plenty of stories of prenups getting thrown out, and I've always wondered, like, how does that, like, what's the point of it if it's just going to get thrown? I didn't know. That makes sense, though.
And then every state has its own rules about, like, witnesses and signatures and stuff like that that, like, people sort of ignore, especially because I'm going to say in our community, the worst thing that we have is thinking that lawyers are lawyers.
What's that mean?
Meaning, my homeboy's a lawyer. He's going to do the contract. Yeah. He's going to do the thing for me. But your homeboy is a personal injury attorney. He don't know a single thing about family law.
Right.
And so now that you only have one witness sign and no notary, this could be the thing that makes your contract not valid.
Mm. Speaking of lawyers, because I feel like a lot of people, I remember when I was younger, anytime I heard the word lawyer, in my mind, all I hear is cha-ching. Like, damn, I'm about to pay all this somebody all this damn money. I ain't trying to get no lawyer. So, like, talk about how, like, not only how important it is, but how everyone, because I've seen people get in messed up situations where they was in the right, where they can come up on a check if they went that route, but it's like, I'm about to hire a lawyer. I ain't got no money. Like, how can, like, normal people that don't make that much get in a position where they could get some legal protection or stuff like that?
Well, so every state has lawyers that do pro bono stuff. So I think that's, like, a huge thing. But I also live on the fence. It depends on what we're talking about. Because I tell people all the time, I threaten people all the time with lawsuits. Yes.
Why?
But for the most part, I mean, they actually did something. Okay. Not just like...
I know.
Yeah. But what I mean is I tell them, like, okay, we'll do a cease and desist letter. We will do a demand letter. We will send them... We'll go through all the song and dance around suing people. We're not going to sue them, though, in real life. The reason is because, do you care about somebody's credit? Most people don't have capacity to pay the lawsuit. So now I have a judgment. Great, you win. It goes on their credit report. Do I care about their credit report? Not at all. I want my money. So if I'm not going to get my money, I'm not going to use any effort to go after it. But most people are so afraid of the law that if you demand enough, they'll just be like, all right, bro, you got it. And they'll just give you the money back or whatever the case. And so I think that, like, the strength and the mysticism around the fear of justice, like, really works. But at the same time, like, pick and choose your battles. Sue big companies because they got deep pockets. Don't sue people because most people don't got the money to pay you. And then you'll just end up with, like, yay, Cardi B won $5 million. But the lady's like,
you ain't getting nothing.
Yeah. Here's on $10. This is what I got. I'll pay you for the rest of my life. $10. Yeah.
That makes sense. And this one of the final topics I want to speak on, speaking of lawsuits and stuff, can you sue a trust?
Yes. But,
okay.
So this is the thing. a good amount of what asset protection is about privacy. And so if it's set up properly, it's going to be hard for them to figure out who to sue.
What do you mean by set up properly?
So now this is why I tell people that your trust shouldn't have your name, because that's way too easy. Like, oh.
So whose name does it have?
It just has a name. It's named Exodus Trust.
But how do you prove that's you?
You don't prove it's you. That's the point. So, like, if no one can figure out what you own, there'll be no reason to sue you. Like, the likelihood that a trust is going to be sued is pretty low, mainly because the trust assets are private. This is a private document. Nobody knows what it owns. So even if you see, like, right, it owns a piece of property, you'll also be able to see that it has a mortgage on it. So then you're like, all right, if that doesn't have sufficient money in like the equity of that property,
there's no point.
Should I pursue going after them any further? Most of the time, unless they find way more properties, which you just shouldn't title it in that way, by the way. But the most people won't sue you because lawyers, most of them are working on contingency. So contingency means they take your case. They won't make any money unless you win. Mm-hmm. So they're going to look for all the assets and then be like, nah, you good. We're not doing this.
So how do you, when we talked about set it up properly, what's those steps like to set it up properly? Because with that being said, it sounds like it's a lot of trust that's just probably not set up properly.
Oh, yeah. Most trusts are not set up properly because they do things like, you got the Xavier Miller Family Foundation Trust. Like, all right, bro. We know you own it. And we're going to find out what's in it by piecing things together. But, like, I talk about privacy is so important because if it takes me 30 seconds to find what most people own, where they live, where their businesses are registered and all of that, like, that shouldn't happen. And for the wealthiest families in the world, you'll never know what they own because none of their names are in public records, period.
So with that being said, when people are looking up this net worth stuff, that's all probably cap.
So net worth, from a generalistic standpoint, is only correct on the people who have large public holdings. So your Bezos, because most of his net worth is in Amazon stock, that's a public company, you can
get an idea.
But if you think he's more rich than a family in Abu Dhabi, you are confused. They just don't have public holdings. And they, like, don't care about being on your top 10 list. Like, who cares? Like, what do you get for that? Nothing. But harassed.
But harassed. Lawsuits, threatened, blackmail, all that.
Exactly. Which is why you want to be the rich neighbor, not the, like, celebrity. So you want to be the rich neighbor of the celebrity who's like, yeah, we don't know what he do, like, at all, because it's completely disconnected. The house is owned by a trust. The trustee is a company, so the company's names are disconnected. Just a solid foundation that doesn't allow your name to be in public records.
That's so cold, because I feel like that's a huge bar specifically for our community, because, you know, in the black community, when we get money, we want everybody to know it.
Yeah.
And I always say, like, I feel like it's like three phases generally that people go through when they get money. The first one is you want everybody to know. The second one is you really don't care if people know. And the third one is you don't want anybody to know. Yeah. And I feel like with wealthy families that's like on that level, I feel like you just mentioned, I don't think they care or want anyone to know how much they really hold them, because like you said, it's going to come with more problems than good.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, the people who they want to do business with already know them and know their level of success. And then everybody else is just like a vulture looking to get something in investment or steal or sue for one reason or another. So it's literally, I cannot think about three good reasons to tell people how much money you make besides it being for the purpose of saying, like, expect more, want more, desire more, be exposed to more, have higher expectations. Other than that, I literally cannot see a reason to do it.
It's not. You're right. I can think of way more reasons why to not do it than to actually do it. And it took me a while to learn that. You know, when I first started to make good money, I was always, I made this month or this year. And then I thought, well, I'm like, yo, why am I doing this? And my mom used to always tell me from day one, she, you know, my mom from the trenches, West Side Chicago, she like, Zay, what's wrong? Why are you doing this?
Right.
Like, you need to stop. Like, don't you know everybody can see, like, what you talking? I'm like, mom, good. Ain't nothing going to happen to me.
Everybody can see what you're doing. 30-second Google search, we know where you live. Wait. 2 seconds on the internet, I know where you at. So
I know what you drive.
Yeah. So you're putting yourself in the position to literally be a target for absolutely no reason.
It's no reason at all. Like, that's crazy. But
I think that we should have money conversations, but I don't think it should be so specific to
the
you
individual
and what you're doing personally, individually, doing. Exactly, and how, you know, how that looks on a day-to-day basis, because it definitely puts a target on your back for absolutely no reason.
Yeah, and you don't see, like, I've been doing this for a while, and I've been in positions to meet a lot of extremely wealthy people. I haven't met one that's just like, unless it's like private one-on-one conversation, they like, yeah, you know, they're not flexing or anything. They just tell them, like, yeah, I did, the company did X hundreds of millions last year. It's like, damn, but as far as publicly on a platform or in group settings, they're not like, yeah, by the way, I did 20 million last. That's not a conversation. So I'm like, when I start piecing that together and getting more mature, I'm like, I'm not fucking talking. That don't even make sense for me to be online talking about how much money I made. It's just a foolish kind of thing, for real.
Exactly. And even like, I always laugh because people are always trying to like humble others and tell them like to not, like, oh, rich people don't wear X, Y, or whatever. And I'm like, it's never been about that.
Facts.
They probably not gonna wear the monogram T-shirt because, like, that's why would you give free advertising to someone else? But yeah, if you walk through Bloomingdale's long enough, you knew that all black sweater that Steve Jobs wore was $900. Like, this is not Baby Games clothes, but at the same time, it's not about the cost. It's about the quality and all that kind of stuff.
Experience
huge, but also understanding that things like fast fashion are ruining the environment.
It is.
So, you know, I get it. Y'all think y'all cute, Fashion Nova, but at the same time, you wear it twice, you throw it in the trash.
Right.
It's so many things that goes into it. And you're just like, man, and I am a little bit old, so I always say how, like, I've literally got clothes, shoes, bags that are older than some of these kids who are like flexing on how many outfits they can buy at Shein for XYZ amount of time. I'm like, yeah, but if you can only keep it for a year, it's not worth it.
No, you're not lying. Like, people do always say, well, wealthy people not spending on this. It's like, but they spend a lot. It's just, it's probably not as gaudy as you would think. Because I was at a hotel. It was like a super nice hotel. I'm not going to say the name of it. And I met the developer of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
We just started talking. And then he's older. He's like 65 probably. And he's like walking around introducing me to everybody and stuff. And then he like, yeah, man, you know, he's like, by the way, it's like, you know, this is like a low key spot. He's like, you know, it's like 4 billionaires in here right now. Cause we like in the bar area.
Yeah.
And I just look around, everybody playing Jane, but the environment it's extremely expensive hotel. So I'm like, that's another way that people got to get this idea that like wealthy people don't spend their money. They do. They just don't spend it like you do.
Yeah,
they're not going to a Louis store buying shirts that say Louis across. They still spending way more than you think, though. But it's on experiences for the most part.
Exactly. Like, I had no idea. Like, so the one good part about running track, right, is that you get to travel the world business class, right? But for me, I didn't know how much business class tickets cost because your agent is booking it, is booking it, whatever. And then, like, the first time I, like, oh, no, I'm about to use my points to upgrade because there is no way I'm paying to pay this much to fly the same flight. And I ain't tall or anything. So, like, I literally don't have a reason to be in business class, even though I prefer it because of the conversations that I have with the people who are sitting next to me. But if I have a 5 a.m. flight, baby, I'm sitting in the back.
Right.
Because I'm not talking to nobody and ain't nobody talking to me.
Facts. Hoodie on. Man, this was a great conversation. And this, before we wrap up, I just want to say, first of all, I appreciate you coming on the show. This has been long overdue. We got to do this again. I feel like there's so much more that we could talk about that's going to even get more people game and blow their minds and all that. Before I let you go, my final question is, what are the... what's your top three books? Because people always ask this question. They want to know what somebody like you has learned and all these things. So what would you say is your top three books?
Ooh, okay. So Number one, How to Make $1 Million an Hour by Les Leopold.
That sounds fire.
Number two, The King of Capital. That's about Steve Schwarzman and him creating Blackstone.
Yep.
And then number three, I just finished, is The 12-Week Year, which is about complete efficiency and like how to keep yourself motivated to like reach your goals and be very intentional about each day and each week. And so I'm incorporating that this year into my mortgage company. We already started talking about it because we've sort of been on this like stagnancy, which is good. We've been in business for a long time since 2012, but I'm like, we're going to do $1 billion in loans this year. And it's going to be on the back of like everybody thinking, oh, interest rates are so high, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, yeah, but people still need money. They're still doing deals. They're still building buildings. There's still going to be commerce. Maybe they're not doing it with you. So we have to make sure that we're intentional and like our 12-week year is got to be like, okay, how many deals do we have on the board? Who's out making conversations? Am I doing enough speaking and engaging with the people who are doing deals? Because we prefer to work with the people who do volume versus like one-offs. I really don't work with a lot of like residential purchases anymore. We focus on investors. But that's, I mean, right, we still have the ability to do those. But, you know, one person with one house versus like the people who are flipping hundreds of houses or building a $100 million building, we prefer to spend our effort bringing in those clients.
Okay. And like I said, we definitely gonna do this again because I like bringing people on multiple times because the conversation just gets better after the familiarity and the relationships getting built, the conversation, the content, it gets better and better. So we definitely gonna do this again. But before I let you go, plug in all your stuff where people can find you, follow you, everything you got going on.
Okay, so the best and easiest way to contact me or follow me is on Instagram. I'm Lala Hurdles 2. On Twitter, I'm Idolette, which is my last name. I'm very active on LinkedIn. You just have to follow my name. And if you really want, you need something, like you're looking for a loan, you're looking for a reference, you're looking for a mentor, you're looking for something, LinkedIn is the place that I actually respond to most of my own messages. And then I'm working on something at the moment to help people with my pillars around wealth preservation and stuff. It'll be my first time doing anything digital whatsoever. I kind of thought it was fugazi before. So, but now that it's getting a little thinner where people are like, all right, not every single person is a coach, not every single person is a guru. I am exploring doing a mentorship program and teaching people more about how to use trust, how to set up their businesses, how to stay private, and how to be an abundant giver.
I love that. And listeners, watchers, y'all heard it. Make sure y'all tap in, follow her on all platforms because she has extremely a lot of value. And wrapping up, y'all can find me on all platforms. I'm at The Official Xavier Miller. And you can find the Millionaire Mindsets platform. That's YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, everywhere you can find us. And that's all I got for this episode on the Millionaire Mindsets podcast. See you guys next episode. Peace.
Gotta get your brain right if you're trying to make $1 million. If you ain't gonna do it for yourself, then do it for your mama. Only stay surrounded by them people if you know they solid. Elevate your hustle up today to double up your profit. Trying to learn some game, Xavier gonna talk about it. No, Deanna, speak that shit that everybody vouching. Ain't no more excuses valid. Get up off the couch and get up in your bag. To your bank account, need an accountant.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.